Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Todd Mayer. Attorney number 32531, representing the appellant, Marion Black. The defense's post-trial motions and their constantly shifting positions, both in the trial court and on appeal, constitute nothing more than attempts to get repeated do-overs regarding choices they made. This case arises out of one sustained objection during testimony and one sustained objection during closing argument. The defense objected to references to certain documents, and when the objection is sustained, they asked for no further relief. No continuance, no jury instruction, no mistrial, nothing. Then, when they didn't like the verdict, they filed a Rule 59 motion, which was based solely on the misconduct of an adversary. And that was denied by operation of law, knowing that Rule 60b-2 relief for a misconduct claim was precluded by their failure to request relief during trial. They switched. They argued Rule 60b-5, an extraordinary circumstances claim. Now on appeal, recognizing that their claim doesn't constitute extraordinary circumstances under Rule 60b-5, they're again recasting it as a misconduct case. On the one hand, they claim it was misconduct by Ms. Black and her counsel, so they should get relief under 60b-2. Alternatively, they say for the first time ever that it was jury misconduct, constituting extraordinary circumstances under 60b-5. They're wrong about all of it. They're stuck with the choices they made at trial, and their Rule 60 motion fails both procedurally and substantively. As an initial matter, I would urge the court to closely review the transcripts regarding what really occurred during the trial, because the defendant's motion and its brief and the trial court's order, which presumably was based on the defendant's representations without the benefit of transcripts, are not accurate. The defendant refers to Ms. Black repeatedly trying to use certain documents and, quote, continuing this same pattern time and time again of questioning. But again, I was only able to find two objections. They objected once during testimony when the witness was going to be presented some of these documents. The objection was sustained. And once in closing argument, they objected, and the objection was again sustained. But the closing argument was actually comment on the expert witness's response to a jury question to which they had objected, or at least which the court had deemed proper and had asked. So that arguably was very game anyways. Turning to the legal questions presented, defendant cannot get relief under Rule 60b-2 for at least two reasons. First, it's not what he asked for in the trial court, and it was not the basis of the trial court's order. The Rule 60 motion in the trial court highlighted only Rule 60b-5, cited only Rule 60b-5 case law. This court did not address the Rule 60 argument by the defendant. It was not raised in the district court and not a basis of the district court's ruling.
Let me ask a question about that. It wasn't raised in the district court, but isn't there an adage that says an appellee can rely on any ground to support the judgment supported by the record, whether or not it was raised or even contemplated by the trial court? In other words, to uphold judicial resources. How would that fit into that?
I don't think it necessarily would fit into that because it wasn't correct under either one. And when you file a written motion under Rule 60b-5, you're supposed to articulate what your reasons are, and they're very different from Rule 60b-2. And to, you know, try to bring it as extraordinary circumstances and then switch and say, oh, no, well, it's B2. I guess I would like it to, if I was up here arguing that certain evidence should have come in, certain hearsay evidence should have come in under Rule 803, you would presumably ask me which subsection Rule 803, and if I said, I don't really care, you know, whichever one you think is best, I don't think you would find that adequate. And I think that's what they try to do here. They always just say Rule 60B, and they never articulate which one are we trying to do?
Let me ask you, counsel, could you inform me whether there's a different standard when it says 60B2 attorney misconduct? Does that reference misconduct that would not have come to light during the trial? In other words, wouldn't if someone was alleging misconduct that's on the record from the trial, wouldn't that have been something that would have been expected to have been raised, say, in a 59 motion? Wouldn't a 60B2 have a different purpose?
I think you're right.
I'm not right. I'm kind of asking.
No, well, the case law indicates that 60B2 has a very different purpose, because if you, under the Antolovich case and the federal case law, if you don't ask for a mistrial or whatever relief you're requesting during trial, then you're out of luck on 60B2. And if they did something horrible after trial, maybe that's a 60B5. Because the 60B5 cases tend to arise when post-trial, things that come up post-trial only. Here, it was very clear at trial that, you know, when this issue arose, they objected. The objection sustained, they just didn't ask for anything different. They took a chance on the jury, and they lost, and they didn't like the result. So that's the second reason that they can't get relief under 60B2, is they didn't ask for anything, and under Antolovich and the federal cases, they waived 60B2. They also can't get relief under 60B5 for at least two reasons. First of it is, 60B5 is a residuary clause. It applies only in situations not covered by the enumerated provision. Well, they raised attorney misconduct. 60B5 is not a way to backdoor a misconduct claim that is actually covered by 60B2.
Well, actually, I thought you said it wasn't covered by 60B2 because there was no motion for mistrial.
Well, both. They waived 60B2 because they didn't make the motion for mistrial. The conduct they're complaining about isn't covered by 60B5 because attorney misconduct is explicitly referenced in 60B2. Had they raised a huge stink at trial about what the attorney misconduct, I think then you get your 60B2 chance to argue 60B2 post. So now in their briefs for the first time they say jury misconduct. That appears nowhere in the motion or the court's order. And it sort of turns the idea of jury misconduct on its head to say, basically, what their argument is that there's evidence was put before the jury, and it shouldn't have come in, and the jury didn't ignore it, we don't think, because we don't like the verdict. So that was jury misconduct. That's really just a way of saying they were prejudiced by what they claim is the attorney misconduct. It's not jury misconduct in any real sense of the word. And the only evidence of any jury misconduct is the fact that one juror submitted one question, to which the defendant apparently did not object, and the court deemed proper because it asked the witness the question. Subsequent to the question and in closing instructions, they were told to disregard anything to which an objection is sustained, but they hadn't made an objection. And just the substance of it was, again, just about these, basically, whether Ms. Black was good at her job, which was a fairly tangential issue to begin with. If nobody really controverted it, the defense's theory was that, yeah, she was good at her job, but after the accident, she was still there. And so, she's fake. You know, so there's no notion of jury misconduct here, certainly not the grievous jury misconduct raising sensitive issues of religion that was deemed horrifying and constituted extraordinary circumstances in Campbell. And that gets to the heart of 60B5 and why they really do not have a claim. 60B5 has been narrowly interpreted to include only extreme situations and extraordinary circumstances. This simply doesn't qualify. Knowing that you're not getting over the various Rule 60 hurdles we've already discussed, they try to shift the focus to what a horribly prejudicial, unjust thing happened to them. But a careful review of the record shows it's just not true. And just as importantly, they certainly didn't feel that way at trial because they didn't do anything about it. They didn't ask for any relief once their objections were sustained. I again, they're vague about what really occurred, because not much really occurred. The controversy was over 5 documents. They were largely redundant of other evidence in the case, basically showing that she was performing well at her job. 2 witnesses, Marion Bell and Yvonne Gary, testified to those facts without any objections by the defense. Then during cross-examination, the defense's accounting expert, Kathy Denson, is asked several questions about the documents, no objections. Eventually, they're going to present her with one of these documents. There's an objection, bench conference, they withdraw the question, no further objections, no further ask for relief. At the very end of Ms. Denson's testimony, a juror submits a question about whether she would expect to have these documents. As the bench conference is not recorded, but the court asked the question, so presumably there was no objection, and the court thought the question was okay. In her answer, she basically puts it on the plaintiffs, saying we requested all the documents in discovery, but they weren't all received. In closing argument, Ms. Black's counsel starts to comment on that answer to the unobjected to jury question about whether she had all the information she received, basically saying, well, our guy had the same stuff, and he was able to get his opinions. Again, the defense objects. It is misleading. There's another bench conference. The objection is sustained. That's it. That I can see. 1 objection during testimony sustained. 1 objection in closing argument also sustained. No request for further relief. It's not extreme. It's not extraordinary. Under Antolovich, they couldn't get relief under 60B2 for that kind of conduct. They certainly cannot get relief under the more exacting standards of Rule 60B5. Whatever import the defense is attributing to the undisclosed documents now, it didn't at trial. Defense chose not to seek any relief beyond exclusion of the documents and to bet on the jury. Rule 6 is not designed to relieve defendants from the consequence of that choice. It's also not a substitute for an appeal. If they didn't like how the trial went, they could have appealed. They did it. Rule 6, the order must be vacated, and the jury's original verdict. Original verdict should be reinstated. I guess I will keep my remaining 2 minutes and 50 seconds for now.
Good morning. Scott James, registration number 42745, appearing for John Roscoe, the appellee. While it's important to have an end to litigation, it's more important that the end should be right. That's the public policy set forth by the Colorado Supreme Court in the case of Aspen Skiing versus Peer. This really echoes the entire purpose of the judicial system, notions of fairness and justice. We're supposed to go through the process and achieve the right result. Allowing a party to keep a judgment that was tainted with unfair tactics during trial subverts the entire system. When a party is deprived of a fair trial, the judgment must not stand. And this principle is especially true where the unfair tactics were the cause of the unfair trial. Now, probably the most important issue for this appeal is the standard of review and what the standard of review means as far as how this court is looking back on what the Jefferson County District Court did. This case is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. The district court's order may not be disturbed unless the district court acted in a manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair manner. Here, the district court made serious findings about how Mr. Roscoe was deprived of having a fair trial.
Were those findings proffered by the defense side? In other words, was this an order put together by the defense?
I suppose the answer is two-parted. Initially, when Mr. Roscoe moved for post-trial relief under Rule 59, the court drafted its own order, and there was no proposed order, and that was the court's analysis. And following that order, when Mr. Roscoe moved for relief under Rule 60B, Mr. Roscoe did provide the court with a proposed order, which incorporated certain findings. So I suppose the answer to your question is yes and no. The abuse of discretion standard acknowledges that the district court is best suited to address the fairness of the proceedings. And this court is to give great deference to the district court's unique role. So we're not Monday morning quarterbacking what the district court did. Now, this case, what's discussed in the briefing, but what we didn't hear much from Ms. Black, is some of the posture of this case. This was not simply a case where Mr. Roscoe moved for Rule 60 relief and the court granted it. The facts are a little bit more complicated. When Mr. Roscoe filed his motion under Rule 59, the time frame for resolving that motion, in fact, expired under Rule 59J.
Couldn't he have appealed from that?
Mr. Roscoe did appeal from that. He filed a timely appeal to the Court of Appeals, and minutes after Mr. Roscoe perfected his appeal, the district court entered a rule purportedly setting aside the judgment under Rule 60. And so Mr. Roscoe amended his notice of appeal, raising the issue of whether this court should remand the case to the district court to consider re-entering this Rule 60 order.
And when you did, and I take it your thought was that mooted out your appeal or your need for an appeal?
Well, so exactly, Your Honor. We looked at it from a common sense approach where the court was in this position to make these findings. The court said this was an unfair trial, and they're trying to get this resolved.
So you essentially chose the avenue instead of appeal. You decided to get Rule 60 relief.
We moved for Rule 60 relief before we filed the notice of appeal, and the court had not ruled on the Rule 60 order. And we were concerned, and we wanted to protect the deadline for appealing the Rule 59 order, so we appealed.
Yeah, and then you basically dismissed the appeal once you got the Rule 60 favorable ruling. So you chose your avenue of proceeding.
Well, the Court of Appeals actually issued an order to show cause as to why the case should not be remanded, and both parties responded to that. Mr. Roscoe did, in fact, request that the court remand, and Ms. Black vigorously opposed that remand, and the Court of Appeals then issued an order providing the district court with permission to consider re-entering the Rule 60 order, which the trial court did, in fact, do, with permission from the district court. And so what we haven't seen any cases dealing with in cited by Ms. Black is any situation addressing kind of unique facts of this. The district court has acted with permission from the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals order specifically says the district court is provided with a limited remand of the district court to allow the district court to consider re-entering the CRCP 60B motion with jurisdiction. So we have permission. Ms. Black made the same arguments that she's making here today. She said, no, Court of Appeals, don't do that. You're just going to allow the district court to commit an error. Don't do this. It's futile. Don't do it. And the Court of Appeals advised that it considered that and remanded the case anyway. So Ms. Black has now recycled those arguments into this current appeal. And what happened in between that time is somewhat indicative. The case proceeded to a second trial, and Ms. Black disclosed all the documents, finally, that were withheld and improperly used during the first trial. And the case proceeded to a jury, no allegations of unfairness. Rules were followed, and the jury returned a verdict for Mr. Roscoe. The right result based on fairness, based on full disclosure of documents where everybody had a chance to play on the same level playing field. And we didn't have that during the first trial. And the issue really was There are several issues. There's no disclosure before trial, and Mr. Roscoe proceeded to trial based on the assumption that there had been full disclosure. And in the record, and we've cited in the brief, there was actually a motion to compel litigated. And Ms. Black told the court that she had produced all the documents regarding her loss of business claim. Mr. Roscoe proceeded to trial based on believing that that was a true representation. And that's a major distinguishing fact from one of the main cases that Ms. Black relies on, the Antolovich case, where there were major discovery disputes before trial. The trial was actually continued because of that. The parties were allowed to reopen discovery, and I believe it was the plaintiff in that matter, made the decision to proceed to trial knowing that there were discovery violations and that there was an incomplete production of documents. And so, when the court was looking at whether that issue could be the basis for setting aside the judgment, the court said, no, you made the decision to go to trial. I asked you, were you ready to go to trial? And you said, yes. That's not the situation here. Mr. Roscoe proceeded to trial based on what later turned out to be an erroneous belief that there had been complete disclosure.
When that erroneous belief, right, Mr. Roscoe's trial counsel did not seek a continuance or a mistrial, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then why isn't the characterization by your opponent correct that Mr. Roscoe rolled the dice below and when he didn't like the result, and now he's coming back and saying he gets a new trial?
Well, the issue is not quite as simple as they have framed it. In fact, each time there was an objection to, Your Honor, we don't know what this document is. We've never seen it. Ms. Black's counsel represented as an officer of the court. No, this has been disclosed. They have this. We have produced this. And we're in the middle of a four-day trial that's moving at a quick pace here. And Ms. Black's suggestion that we should have assumed that those representations to the court were false, and that we should have somehow in the middle of trial said, they're saying it's disclosed, but they're not telling the truth to the court.
Well, didn't the court sustain the objection on the basis that plaintiff's counsel below couldn't provide any substantive response to your non-disclosure objection?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't that resolve the question that it wasn't disclosed?
Well, I mean, not according to Ms. Black. I believe if you review carefully in the briefing, there's still no admission that these documents were not disclosed. They are still taking the position that these documents were properly disclosed and that somehow there was some issue with the Bates numbering. So there's never been a full acknowledgement that these were not disclosed.
But I guess my question was a little different. Once trial counsel to Mr. Roscoe objects on the ground of non-disclosure, the court says, I'm not satisfied there was disclosure, therefore I'm sustaining the objection. Doesn't that mean that Mr. Roscoe should have gone forward assuming they weren't disclosed for purposes of his decision whether to seek a continuance or a mistrial? I mean, I don't see how you can have that both ways.
Well, I think what Ms. Black is relying on is the interpretation from the Antolovich case, where it's a little bit different posture, where the court denied relief under Rule 60, and there were a number of issues raised post-trial, but there was no bright-line test set forth that a party has to. They waive their right to move for post-trial relief if they don't request a continuance. Those were things that the court pointed out that you knew about this going into trial. At times, you didn't even object, and then you didn't even do this or this. So there were multiple factors, and the Court of Appeals is looking at those, saying, we're looking for a manner to try to, you know, under this deferential abuse of discretion standard, we're giving deference to the trial court's findings that none of these things happened. And here, I think if we look at the end result of this, the trial court's orders and findings, the court found that there were real problems with the fairness of this trial, even though the objections were sustained. And so that comes into kind of the next issue, where the court has instructed the jury to, you are to disregard questions and if there's an objection, sustain. And obviously, the trial court acknowledged that there's the standard where we presume that the jury followed the law, but that that can be overcome with an indication that they haven't. And the court relied on the Quest versus Blood case for that proposition, cited in the order, and found that the juror questioned after the jury had been instructed on these issues indicated that they were focusing and, in fact, fixated, is the word the trial court used, fixated on the improper issues. So the court was not satisfied that Mr. Roscoe got a fair trial. And really, the policy behind, set forth by the Colorado Supreme Court, is really what we have to look at here. Ms. Black didn't follow the rules at trial. She didn't disclose documents. She used them in a manner which was improper, and the court noted that this was a serious issue because this was a battle of the experts, an admitted liability auto accident case where the only issue is the damages. And the damages in this case, while minimized by Ms. Black, the major issue in this case was her loss of business claim. Defendant's only witness on that issue, the witness on that issue was Ms. Denson, a forensic accountant. And Ms. Black used this tactic, knowing that these documents had not been disclosed, to discredit Ms. Denson. And so the court found that that was particularly egregious in this battle of the expert cases to take documents that you know that the other expert hasn't considered because you haven't disclosed them, and then to suggest, well, your opinions are incomplete because you didn't even consider these documents that we never produced. But, you know, that's just, the court noted that that was an unfair tactic and that it tainted the process. And then the jury's failure to follow the instructions also weighed into it. So as much wrangling as we can do to try to classify what we've said, what we haven't said, whether it's 60B2, 60B5, those are all just attempts to ignore kind of the overarching policy. We need to reach the right result.
When the jury sent back the question that indicated it may not have followed the instruction, was your counsel aware of that, that the jury had asked that question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there a motion for mistrial made at that point based on the, gee, there must be some lingering effect here going on?
There was no motion for mistrial at any point during the trial court proceeding.
In fact, there's not even any indication that Mr. Roscoe objected to the asking of that question.
Your Honor, there's certainly no record of it. The Jefferson County District Court did not hold, I believe that was during a bench conference, and I don't believe the bench conferences were recorded, so there's no record of it.
Well, whose responsibility was, I'm sorry, Judge, whose responsibility was it to make a record if there was an objection?
Well, that if there is an objection, I believe it would be Mr. Roscoe's trial counsel's responsibility. And I believe I am out of time, so if there's not further questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, counsel notes that this is an abuse of discretion standard that applies, and that is generally true as to these post-trial motions. I would simply point out that a court does not have discretion to commit legal error, which would occur if it either granted Rule 50B5 relief based on misconduct, which is a ground covered by another provision of the rule, or for that matter, if it granted 60B2 relief for a party who had failed to ask for that relief during trial. Also, the Spencer case establishes that it is an abuse of discretion to grant Rule 60B5 relief absent extraordinary circumstances. In this case, just simply does not present extraordinary circumstances. Counsel attempts to distinguish Antolovich based on the timing of disclosures, and I don't think Antolovich is crystal clear on that. It appeared to me that there was some sort of misconduct that led to a continuance, but then additional disclosures late because they in their decision they referred to not asking for a further continuance. So it appears that the Antolovich case is more similar to our case than counsel would lead us to believe. And certainly the federal case is just like ours. It was stuff that occurred during trial. And because they didn't ask for a mistrial, they don't get Rule 60b-2 relief. Counsel referred sort of obliquely to its law of the case arguments. Those have no merit, and I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on them. And finally, counsel spent a lot of time on fairness and getting the right result. And we can't Monday morning quarterback the district court. Well, what defense wants to do is Monday morning quarterback the jury. And that's why we have these rules and deadlines and rules about asking for the relief that you want during trial. Otherwise, you get exactly what happened here. They don't ask for any relief during the trial. They get a verdict they don't like. A month goes by or so. And then they submit a wildly inaccurate motion that the court has to review after the fact without the benefit of transcripts that, you know, talks about this pervasive misconduct time and time again. Well, no, it was one objection during testimony, one objection during closing argument. The court is busy. It's probably had a couple trials in the interim. It doesn't remember the details, so it does an order that doesn't hold up when you look at the record. We do not have, in this case, extraordinary circumstances, extreme circumstances. This was a rather pedestrian case of evidence being objected to, not being admitted.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Can you see that or not?
Yes, it's not possible tonight.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Having concluded our business for the morning, the court will stand in recess, subject to call, and available to someone else.